You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including why oaks might be just as important as Douglas firs in Oregon, the spread of an invasive insect in the state, and why Roseburg was talking about homeless camps this week. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
I'm Peyton Gast, JPR's Snowden intern for the summer.
And I'm Theo Greenlee, Jefferson Public Radio's newest South Coast reporter.
And I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
Roman, you brought us a story about an effort to restore oak habitat in southern Oregon. Why does this habitat need to be restored?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at this area where this habitat is, it doesn't really look like oak habitat anymore at all. We drove up into this forest that just looks like any other conifer forest in the area. It's really dense. There's a lot of little fir saplings and stuff. But I was talking with a tribal representative who told me, you know, that this area historically was really more of like an open oak savanna. I mean, it was very wide open. There were a few oak trees here and there and a lot of underbrush plants and bushes and stuff like that. And the fir trees have essentially kind of invaded the oak habitat and are slowly killing off the oak trees. There was one that I saw that was just completely surrounded on all sides by these little fast-growing fir trees, and they kind of end up blocking the light and then killing the oaks. A person I talked to said there's only an estimated 10% of the historical oak habitat left in the Pacific Northwest. Another part of the problem is that this oak habitat is in the lowland valleys where people like to live, and so they kind of it gets also taken over and used for farmland as well, which is a problem. So this group, the Klamath Siskiyou Oak Network, is made up of a bunch of different nonprofits and partners, and they do some individual oak restoration projects around the area. But this project I went to is a big one that the network is doing all together just east of Medford.
And what kind of benefits does oak habitat bring that isn't there when it's just a fir trees?
Yeah, and it's not necessarily like that oak habitats are like better than fir tree habitats. It's that it kind of brings different kinds of plants and animals, and that there isn't a lot of oak habitat now, so they want to bring more of that. A big one is birds. You know, there's a lot of birds that prefer oak habitat to the dense conifer forest, so the birds aren't there anymore. And so this oak habitat produces a lot of acorns, and the other plants and shrubs attract a lot of bugs that the birds like to eat. And so when this oak habitat is restored, those birds that prefer the habitat will return to the area where they previously had not been. It also provides a lot of habitat for migrating birds, kind of like a pit stop for them on their way somewhere else, or a summer habitat for other birds. So this group also said that a big part of this restoration is wildfire prevention, because the oak habitat is meant to have these wildfires regularly. Oak trees are built and to resist, you know, wildfires, especially these less intense wildfires which happen in the oak habitats compared to, you know, those huge raging infernos that happen in big, dense forests. So the fire kind of cleans out all the underbrush and debris and kills the fir trees that are trying to come in. And it also makes it easier for firefighters to control if it gets near someone's house. So restoring more of this habitat will make it easier to prevent major wildfires in the future.
And how does the Oak Collaborative bring this back, all this habitat? And, you know, how do they choose where to do it?
Yeah, it takes a lot of planning. And that's what I learned, is that they are sitting at the table a lot talking about where exactly to do this. The goal for this specific project is to restore 4,000 acres over 6 years. And this is the first major project they've done since developing the strategic plan in 2020, where they basically looked, you know, across all of Southern Oregon and Northern California, figure out, well, where is the best places to restore this oak habitat that's going to have the most impact? So they came up with, you know, some parts of the project that could be easily completed initially once they got funding, and then other project parts that would be harder and more difficult to do and would happen later on. You know, a big part of this project is doing work across public and private land.
Mm-hmm.
And because if it's all clumped together, then it's going to be a lot more effective, this habitat. So, you know, they've told me they had a lot of interest from private landowners, so much so that there's like a waiting list for oak restoration.
And how is the project going?
It's going well. I mean, they're in the middle of year four. They've already gotten a lot of work done, and they're already seeing that work have the impacts. So the birds that they were talking about that like that oak habitat are already returning to the area that, you know, they hadn't seen before the restoration. And you can really see how much more open the forest is. In the story, I did talk a little bit about how there are a lot of fir trees that are still left, the really large fir trees that they can't cut down because they're reserved for timber sales by the BLM. But, you know, even so, the stuff they were was able to cut down, you know, has made a lot of impact.
And it sounded like lots of landowners were interested. Is there any future work planned?
There aren't any major projects right now other than finishing this current one, though one of the partners in that work is doing some oak restoration work around Table Rocks right now. And unfortunately, there isn't any money to do any follow-up maintenance on this oak habitat. It's going to have to be maintained with prescribed fire in the future to keep the firs from taking over again. And so that work is going to be up to the private landowners and the BLM, but they're hoping that they'll be able to get more money and do more projects in the future.
Okay, well, thank you, Roman. Peyton, this week you covered the effects of the invasive emerald ash borer on southern Oregon trees. What are the risks of these beetles?
Yeah, so the emerald ash borer is kind of a pretty insect. They're like green and iridescent, but they're wreaking absolute havoc on our ash trees.
But they're not actually here in southern Oregon yet.
They're not in southern Oregon yet, no. but they are eventually going to arrive here, but they burrow and lay eggs inside of the ash trees, and then they eat away at the bark until the trees eventually die off. But yes, it's important to know that the ash borer have not arrived in southern Oregon yet. However, we do have a lot of ash trees sort of in the low-level wetlands here in southern Oregon. So think the Rogue River and Umpqua basins. And the trees can get up to 75 feet long. They're pretty big, and they provide a lot of really good shade and habitat for fish and wildlife. And several experts from the Department of Forestry, Department of Agriculture, OSU Extension Services are saying that there's a lot to be lost if these ash trees die off from this invasive species.
And can we do anything to protect the ash trees from the emerald ash borer?
Yeah, so experts are saying sort of. You know, emerald ash borer are an invasive species, and because they're an invasive species, they're kind of tricky because our native ash trees don't know how to defend themselves against these beetles because, you know, they're from southeastern Asia. So our trees are really susceptible to death, unfortunately. But Dan Stark is a professor at OSU. And he's saying that one of the best things the community can do is just learn about these ash trees and the telltale signs of infestation so that they can report it to experts and let them deal with it. And on the professional side, you know, they've been testing out biocontrols like these really interesting parasitoid wasps, which are sort of a natural predator to the emerald ash borer. They've also been using insecticides that they can, you know, inject in infested trees, and that's worked pretty well too. But sometimes the best method is just to remove the trees altogether because, you know, once they get infested, they can become really brittle, branches can start falling, and they can get kind of dangerous. So, yeah.
And do we know how long it will be until the emerald ash borer arrives in southern Oregon?
That's sort of the million-dollar question. It can happen tomorrow or it can happen 20 years from now. Naturally, the ash borer can travel around 10 miles a year, but they tend to travel way quicker because humans just move them. The ash borer are really, they're known to love dead and dying wood. So a lot of times they'll burrow into firewood. And that's why experts are urging people to burn firewood where you buy it and don't move it more than 10 miles outside of where it was first collected. And that way the beetles don't accidentally get introduced to a new region where they haven't touched yet.
Okay, thanks so much, Peyton. Jane, you reported on a Roseburg City Council meeting this week. What happened there?
So city councilors on Monday voted down some proposed changes to the city's tent camping resolution. It was passed back in 2022, and it basically allows nonprofit or public or commercial entities to operate regulated homeless camps with the goal of helping address Roseburg's homelessness crisis. And so far, the only organization that has actually opened any sites under the program is a developer called Elk Island Trading Group. And so councilors were looking at some updates to those regulations from 4 years ago, but they ultimately voted those down on Monday in a vote of 5-2.
And what were the proposed changes and why were people proposing them?
There was a whole big long list of things they were proposing to change. They were considering adding a 14-day public comment period for new sites, establishing a 2-year permit for each site, so you'd have to reapply every 2 years, prohibiting site operators from requiring residents to work as a condition of staying there, which is a practice that Elk Island has used and has received some pushback for. The city says that these proposed changes were created because of a request from Elk Island's operations manager, Bernie Woodard, although he said at the meeting that he disagreed with almost all of the proposed changes, so only a few of them were things that he wanted to see. The city said they also were trying to improve consistency, accountability, public safety, neighborhood compatibility, you know, trying to update these regulations. And the city staff also said that there have been some complaints from people who are neighboring these tent camp properties. And so they're trying to balance that, too. So that's what they say was their goal with these proposals.
And not everyone was in favor. What did opponents have to say?
There were two major sources of pushback to these proposals. The first one was that it would make it too hard for operators to operate these sites and discourage anyone from opening any new sites. There was also some confusion about whether or how Elk Island sites would be grandfathered in. So if they were eventually maybe forced to close, then they have no tent campsites in the city, which some people really, really want and say are needed. It's kind of the point. And people spoke during public comment, the city councilors, even Bernie Woodard himself, all said that these proposals are too restrictive and would make it too hard for operators to operate at all. Like I said, the city councilors voted it down, not unanimously, but 5-2. And then the other pushback was sort of this question, why is the city focusing on this issue rather than addressing unmanaged homelessness in the city in places like Deer Creek Park, where homeless people often camp? The police chief said at the meeting the city has received more complaints about Deer Creek Park than about any of Elk Island sites. And the city doesn't have any sites itself. They were supposed to talk on Monday about some parking lots to be used as a potential urban campground. That was never discussed. That will be moved to the next meeting. The city council has considered and rejected multiple sites for an urban campground. They canceled a deal to buy property meant for that purpose. And meanwhile, Bernie Woodard says Elk Island recently had to shut down one of his camps because of interference from unmanaged camping in Deer Creek Park. So that was another pushback, basically, that this should not be the priority and the city should focus on unmanaged camping and creating an urban campground.
Okay, thanks so much, Jane. And welcome to Theo Greenlee. Welcome to the debrief, Theo.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you're our new South Coast reporter for JPR. What brought you here?
Well, I just started this week, as the newest addition to the newsroom, and I'm here through at JPR through Report for America, which is a nonprofit that places journalists in newsrooms around the United States to cover underreported issues and communities. And this is actually my second stint as a Report for America reporter. I'll be reporting down from the Southern Coast, but I did a stint started in 2021 and did a 3-year service as an RFA reporter before that.
Yeah. And so you're coming to us kind of on your second stint of RFA. Tell us a little bit about where you were before this.
Alaska, the Aleutian Islands specifically. So the Aleutian Islands are it's an archipelago that stretches basically from Alaska all the way across the Bering Sea to Russia, and it's a string of over 100 islands and just many, many, many smaller islands and about a dozen communities around there. It's a region people may associate with the deadliest catch. On Alaska is the main community center there. Dutch Harbor is the port, and that's where they filmed the Discovery Channel documentary reality show, Deadliest Catch. So my reporting there, you know, I covered commercial fishing, indigenous affairs, Arctic shipping, military activity, the exclusive economic zone, and a lot of very adorable stories about marine mammals. My last story there actually was about the Pribilof Islands, which are, there's this one island, about 300 people live there, and it's just a really fascinating history. And the Ununga people there, the Alaska Native folks, were wards of the state of the U.S. government all the way until the 1980s. And I just did a story that aired on Morning Edition last week, so some JPR listeners may have heard it.
Great. And you're what we're calling our South Coast reporter. What will you be covering and what interests you about this area?
Yeah, so I'll be covering mainly Curry and Coos counties. And so I'll be just kind of covering everything, I hope, that is important to local community members there, you know, local government, the economy, indigenous affairs, and fishing. I really hope to cover, to do a lot of commercial fishing stories. That's something that really interests me and that I've been covering in Alaska for the last 5 years. I will say that yesterday I went down to the Port of Charleston, down to the marina, I should say, and I had on my Dutch Harbor sweatshirt, and I wasn't out of the car for 30 seconds before somebody said, "Hey, when'd you get back from Dutch?"
Okay, well, thanks, Theo. We've got to wrap it up right now, but that's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.